We're talking about apocalyptic thinking, and it's not just that people are entertained by end-time stories. A lot of us believe them. Cultural critic Barry Vacker directs the Center for Media and Destiny, and he told Steve Paulson that 27% of Americans really believed that the world would end when the Mayan calendar did in 2012.
27% of Americans thought the world was going to end like the Mayan prophecy?
Yes, 27% thought it was likely to happen. The number in China was 20%. In another survey, the percentages of people believing in apocalyptic scenarios is extremely high. 37% of Americans believe that the day after tomorrow could happen, and that's the Roland Emmerich film about instant climate change and instant ice age. 31% believe that Armageddon could happen. That's the one with the meteor hitting us. So there's been there are a lot of beliefs out there, various apocalyptic scenarios. The Mayan one was easy to discredit, but I think that kind of worked as a cover story because, let's face it, the war on terror is apocalyptic. Iraq is apocalyptic. I think you could say that war itself is apocalyptic.
So this obsession with the coming end of the world, I mean, it helps to explain a lot of the books and movies and TV shows that
yes.
trade on this idea. And, you know, dystopianism obviously fits into this as well.
Yes, exactly.
You know, and the sort of the sci-fi fantasy stuff, zombies, vampires, it's all sort of part of the same thing. But then I guess it raises the question, well, are all those movies and books and TV shows creating this apocalyptic fervor or are they reflecting it?
I think it's probably both because growing up in the Cold War, which ended in 1990 and 91, there was the fear of the nuclear apocalypse. That is not on the radar near as much. But we now have the ecological apocalypse, whether that's measured as climate change, rising ocean levels, global warming, ecological destruction. There's also the idea of a resource apocalypse, that we're going to exhaust the Earth's resources. And there's also the idea of the digital apocalypse, that we will create these machines that will be so powerful and so small that they will go in and alter human consciousness and create a new human. So the real human will be gone and be replaced by some kind of digitalized human. That's sort of the Ray Kurzweil scenario.
Right.
And you mentioned the zombie apocalypse. And I would say there's two others. The cosmic apocalypse, the idea that Earth could get obliterated by the cosmos, be it a meteor, asteroid, black hole, supernova. The scenarios always have embedded, sometimes explicitly, sometimes implicitly, an end and a beginning.
Well, and my guess is that this apocalyptic meme operates at some emotional level as well. And you have this fascinating discussion in your book about how experiencing this sense of the apocalypse allows us to get to the sublime, almost sort of a religious experience. Can you explain this?
Well, I would say that the sublime doesn't have to be a religious experience at all. I would say the sublime is the sense of awe and wonder, often tinged with terror. And it's that feeling when we gaze upon the stars in a night sky, on a clear night sky, you know, away from the cities where we can actually see the stars. We see the radiant ribbon of the Milky Way going across the sky. So we're in awe and wonder. Or maybe we're standing on the rim of the Grand Canyon and we look down in it and we experience this awe and wonder. So the sublime is what happens when we confront several different things, one of which would be the vast forces of nature, the forces that made the Grand Canyon, the forces of the cosmos, maybe, you know, the forces of a tidal wave. We can also have a sense of the technological sublime. In other words, we can marvel at the powers of the internet and just to sort of contemplate the fact that there's 1.5 billion people hooked up to the internet. No, I think it's more than that. I think it's up to 2 billion now, whatever the total is. But we have billions of people hooked up to the internet and it's been running for over 25 years without ever turning off. And we can sort of contemplate this vast network that we're building. It's awe-inspiring, but yet its surveillance powers are terrifying. Its ability to trivialize knowledge down to, you know, the 30-second soundbite on YouTube is also kind of terrifying. So the sublime can give us this sense of something awesome, powerful, amazing, and even wondrous is happening. But if it's life-threatening or challenges our worldview or challenges our sense of how big we are in the universe, some people might find it terrifying too.
Well, I want to go back to this idea of the cosmic sublime, sort of the, you know, tapping into the larger universe. And you make the point that to some degree it goes back to that very famous Apollo 8 photo from 1968, you know, the first photo that showed the Earth from these astronauts who were circling the moon and arguably the most influential photograph in history.
Well, I think it had an impact because it was the first time we were able to get off the planet and look back at the planet. And as several of the astronauts had referred to, we went to the moon, but we discovered Earth. But what most people don't know is that the let's make sure everybody knows what image we're talking about. Mm-hmm. It's called Earthrise. It's the one with Earth rising above the moon's surface. It was captured, I believe, on December 24th by the Apollo 8 astronauts. And so what we see is this image of Earth coming up above the blank horizon or the desolate horizon of the moon, and the Earth is floating against a black sky. But that image has been flipped. The original image, Earth was not coming up over the horizon. It was coming around the horizon. The original image, there's nothing under Earth.
So the moon is on the one side, on the right side, and the right Earth is on the left side.
Floating on its own. And why NASA changed that, I think it's pretty clear. The image is much more comforting when Earth is rising above the moon. There's still something under it. It's more like a sunrise, as opposed to Earth, what we would call this image, Earth void, Earth floating in the void there.
Well, let's skip ahead then in our technology to our own time with all of the new technologies, social media, Facebook. Is there any connection between this and, that sense of the global, of the cosmic from 40 years ago?
Well, that's a great question. And one of the things we have to understand is that media technologies, and by this I mean the telescopes we have, the computers, the internet and things, that are able to peer out beyond our night skies into the vast universe, we now know that there's far more than the Milky Way. So on any given night, you walk out away from your city in the remote vastness of the desert, you'll see 3,000 to 4,000 stars, something like that with your naked eye. But the Milky Way has at least 1 to 200 billion stars. There are at least 100 to 200 billion galaxies, each with hundreds of billions of stars. And those galaxies are basically all moving away from each other in vast webs and networks, pushed apart by these vast voids of what apparently is some kind of dark energy. And the universe is enormously vast and enormously old, and we're not at the center of space or the center of time. Science has given us the infinite.
Well, and then I suppose one other parallel then is just as we are not the center of the universe, in Facebook, there is no center. I mean, there are a multiplicity of different little nodes.
Yes, exactly, except each user, it seems if you're the center. And I would say that social media are how we counter the effects of cosmic media. Let's say the Hubble telescope looking out is cosmic media. And so, in a sense, when you go into Facebook or to Twitter, it's as if you're the center of the vast network. And in a way, it's a network starring you, about you, integrated around you. And so you're seeing this sort of in this mediated universe that we inhabit, where the internet is running 24/7 and it's wireless, it's all around us. There's a way to anchor yourself with social media that I think is a existential consolation for the fact that we're not the center of anything. We can pretend like we are. We're the center of nothing, so we can pretend like we're the center of everything.
So getting back to our discussion of the apocalypse then, I mean, mm-hmm. we're bringing in then, the impact of new technologies. And you write about what you call the virtual apocalypse. What is that?
Facebook.
what makes that apocalyptic, though?
Well, I'm borrowing the term. I did not invent the term virtual apocalypse. I'm borrowing the term from the French theorist who sort of extended Marshall McLuhan's ideas, and that would be Jean Baudrillard. And he wrote of a culture in which media had so permeated our world, so permeated our surrounding diaspora of our homes, our houses, our businesses, that what we have is a world in which everything we know to be true and real is filtered through media. It comes through media, such that media, in effect, are destroying reality. The reality in the sense of the original reality or an authentic reality or an untouched reality. He would probably say Facebook is the same thing, because the amount of time spent in Facebook, you're actually creating a world in which your mediated life is more important and more valuable and more seductive than actually a real life.
Well, that's a very cynical view of this. I mean, some people would say, they're having very real interactions with other people they might not be able to, have face-to-face encounters with.
I would say they're having simulated encounters. I don't think you can get the depth of experience. And this is not a Luddite position. I'm not against Facebook. I'm just trying to explain it here. That I think that it's a simulation of it. I think you can simulate friendship and simulate agreement by you can do a thumbs up. You like it, right? Without having to really think about it or analyze it. Or you can do a quick thumbs down without really having to critically engage it. It's a simulated experience of friendship, a simulated experience of connecting. I don't think it's the real deal.
I can't help wondering if we would be better off without these apocalyptic memes. Which raises the question, is there a better meme out there to think about our future?
Well, you know, it's interesting because there are for the memes to survive, they have to offer some kind of benefit. And there are a couple of others that I didn't get to, these benefits, one of which is the clean slate. Sweep aside the mistakes, sweep aside the debris, and start over. And I think everybody in their personal lives has at one time said, man, if I could just start over, I might do something different. Or if I could just get past this big problem, I'll sweep it aside and I'll begin anew. And I think what's true for the individual is also true for society in many ways. And so I would say sort of at the end of the day, though, there's still this question of our significance in this grand narrative of the universe as revealed by our technologies. And that's what I call the sort of the cosmic apocalypse, the idea that we could be obliterated by the vast universe. But more importantly, what if we're not? What if we just keep going on? And what does it mean to be in this vast universe of which we're seemingly insignificant? And that triggers what I call the philosophical apocalypse. For the fact is our social and cultural and philosophical narratives have not caught up with what our science has revealed. What does it mean to exist on a tiny planet in a vast universe? Are we insignificant, or have we evolved? Are we one form of cosmic evolution that allows the universe to know itself? Maybe that's our justification to continue to exist, is that we are one small way that the universe has become aware of itself and has created a lot of art and a lot of science and technology to try to know that universe and make meaning of it. That might be the best reason to justify our existence. Surely it's not because of all the tribal wars and imaginary great destinies.
Barry Vacker directs the Center for Media and Destiny, and he teaches at Temple University. Steve Paulson talked with him about his book, The End of the World Again.